This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think first we need to learn how private sector and the public sector can work together in unison, collaboratively, rather than separately. That's not something we've been able to do very well.
That's Russell Riesenberg of South Africa's Rural Health Advocacy Project about news that the government has purchased its first supplies of COVID-19 vaccines. Details coming up. And also in Cameroon, separatists are blamed for deadly bombings. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Officials in Cameroon have ordered the military to hunt down separatist fighters who are blamed for planting bombs that killed 4 soldiers and a journalist. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, which injured 3 others. Moki Edwin Kenteka reports from Yaoundé.
Deben Chofor, governor of Cameroon's northwest region, says at about 1 a.m. on Wednesday, roadside bombs exploded near a convoy of government officials being escorted by the military. Chofor says the delegation was returning to the town of Mbengwe from the Njikwa and Andek districts, where the officials went to officially install administrators recently appointed by President Paul Biya.
La triste nouvelle du meurtre brutal.
He says 4 troops and a female journalist were killed when improvised explosive devices planted by separatist fighters exploded on a road near the English-speaking northwestern town of Mbengwe. He says 3 other government officials who received life-threatening injuries were rushed to hospitals. He says 3 troops are still missing and that there were huge material losses. Chofor says the military has been deployed to fish out perpetrators of the act within the shortest period of time. Fuda Eteba Benoit Nikas, the most senior government official in the Mumut administrative unit, when Jikwa and Andek are found, was unheard. The government says he was the main target. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. A statement from Cameroon's Minister of Communication, René Emmanuel Sadi, blames separatists. Among those killed was Liwusi Rebecca Jemmy, a female journalist and highest government communication official in the Mumu administrative area. Her boss, Louise Marie Beignet, Northwest Regional Delegate of Communication, condemns the killing.
Becky était une collaboratrice pleine de vie.
He says Liwusi Rebecca Jemmy was a committed and highly professional journalist. Media professionals in Cameroon will always remember. He says it is unfortunate that a harmless individual should be killed under such circumstances. Jemmy's death has prompted condemnation from journalist associations, churches and NGOs. Roslyn Oba is coordinator of the Cameroon Community Media Network. She says it is imperative for both the military and the fighters to end the separatist crisis in the English-speaking regions, which has killed more than 3,000 people in the past 4 years. Oba says journalists should never be targeted by either the fighters or government troops.
We are there to report the news and say it as it is, and in no way should we be considered as parties or actors in conflict. And so we condemn in very strong terms the killing of our colleague. We are by this encouraging peaceful resolution of this crisis using a non-violent approach, and that these parties take to the dialogue table so that the casualties recorded that has involved one of us should be a thing of the past.
Armed separatists have been fighting in the northwest and southwest regions since 2017 to create an English-speaking state. The separatists complain of marginalization by Cameroon's French-speaking majority. The UN says more than 500,000 people have been displaced by the crisis. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The South African government says it has bought 1.5 million doses of the AstraZeneca firm's COVID-19 vaccine from India's Serum Institute. The vaccines require 2 doses. The health ministry says they will arrive in 2 batches later this month and in February and will be given mostly to healthcare workers. Citizens and civil society groups have been criticizing the state for so far not rolling out vaccines in the African country most affected by the pandemic. Since March 2020, more than 1 million people in South Africa have been infected with COVID-19, which has claimed the lives of more than 31,000 in Johannesburg. Darren Taylor spoke with healthcare delivery expert Russell Riesenberg of South Africa's Rural Health Advocacy Project shortly after news had broken about the vaccine acquisition.
I think the news is super encouraging, as there's been much discussion in the South African space on maybe a lack of planning on the part of government to ensure that healthcare workers are protected. And I think the news of the early arrival of the vaccine, now January as opposed to 1st April, is very, very encouraging in the broader response to COVID-19 and the second wave we're currently experiencing.
Now, Russell, you work in the field of rural health. Do you have any concerns about how they are going to get these vaccines to specifically people working in rural areas?
I think I do have some concerns, and I think obviously the first part of securing the vaccines was by far the easiest part. South Africa's very complex implementation environment is going to make it really difficult. So I think we have an opportunity now with this initial phase one rollout to maybe learn some of the lessons that we need to learn for phase two and phase three. A lot of the private sector capacity is concentrated in our cities, but as you move out of the cities, it's almost exclusively public sector facilities. So how the vaccine is rolled out will also have an impact on that. If we create like a central body to coordinate and distribute the vaccines, we're pretty good. But if you're going to follow our normal institutional arrangements where the national government is responsible for the regulations and X, Y, and Z, and the provinces are responsible for the delivery, I think we're going to have a challenge because we're going to have 10 different delivery systems. And it's not quite clear how we're going to ensure that all of these work in unison.
What are your feelings with regard to the way that the South African government has so far handled or communicated what they are doing around securing vaccine supplies? Because there's been a lot of unease.
I think the main challenge has been clear, transparent communication about who they're negotiating with, what the terms of their non-disclosure agreements are, and when these discussions began. We know that the vaccine task team was set up in September last year, and we also know that many of the vaccines only started getting approved in December. But I think last Sunday was the first time that we heard of the various plans that are out there. With the low levels of trust in the South African system, it's important that we update more rather than less. Getting ahead of some of the media concerns and concerns of the general public would definitely help create a vaccine acceptability within South Africa. I think all these conversations and criticism all over the place just contributes to greater mistrust and could impact negatively on a vaccine rollout plan.
What do you think South Africa should learn from a vaccine rollout such as this, which is obviously a massive undertaking?
I think first we need to learn how private sector and the public sector can work together in unison, collaboratively, rather than secretly. That's not something we've been able to do very well. Even within COVID, it took us months to negotiate service level agreements between public sector hospital and private sector hospitals. I think we need to go back and look and see where those problems were. I think a second component is also just to maybe better understand some of the costing implementations. We still have some challenges in our private sector where they operate on a fee-for-service basis. So the cost of delivering the vaccine using private facilities may be up to 2 to 3 times higher than what it would cost in the public sector setup. I think the big concern remains around equity. How do we ensure that the people that need the vaccines get them when they need them, and that we can avoid situations where those who are not necessarily high in risk get the vaccine before medically necessary?
That was South African healthcare activist Russell Riesenberg in a conversation with Darren Taylor in Johannesburg. Just before Ghana's new parliament members were to be sworn in today, a confrontation occurred between opposing parties, and the military had to intervene to subdue the clash. The French news agency AFP reports the chaotic scene lasted several hours until the army stepped in, with national television broadcasting the drama live. The new Ghanaian parliament is virtually split down the middle between the country's two main parties, posing the risk of gridlock, even for key issues on the agenda, such as how to run around an economy hard hit by the coronavirus pandemic. President Nana Akufo-Addo, who narrowly won re-election in the December 27th vote, also is being sworn in today. His new patriotic party lost 32 seats in the 275-member parliament. Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madabouli said that President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has directed him to start a transition into a modern civil democratic state. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed al-Shenawi. On Tuesday, we accidentally played the wrong audio for this report, so we are bringing it to you today with our apologies for the error.
Well, in recent weeks, we have seen many cases that made many people think that this government is backing the Salafis and the militants and extremist views on everything, family, women's status, minorities. And so those accusations that the regime is aligning itself with the Salafis affected the power base of Sisi regime. Copts, who are 10% of the population, women, who are 49% of the population, liberals, leftists. And so the government wanted to dispel any misgivings and suspicions among the public opinion. And so they made this statement with the hope that they would calm the anguish and fears and suspicion of those social groups.
Is it feasible to transform the political system in Egypt into a democratic state following a parliamentary election that produced a pro-government majority and after amending the constitution to give the president vast power and extend his term limits?
As you know, transition to democracy is a gradual historical educational process. It is not an abrupt change. Institutions and culture need to change. In Egypt, this needs delinking the political system from using religion, and Al-Azhar, which its main job today is promoting or defending public policy and demonizing enemies and opponents of the regime. So this is very difficult because the constitution itself has many articles that support a religious state, like Article 2 about the sources of legislation comes from Islamic Sharia, or Article 7 that talks about the role and power of the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar and Al-Azhar in interpreting everything. So media and education need to change away from using religion to explain politics and society. And this is not happening. If you remember, the first president of Egypt after 1952 was Mohammed Naguib. And he had this famous saying, in order to rule Egypt, one has to have two institutions, Al-Azhar and the army. And up till today, this formula has not changed.
Although the European Union expressed its concern over human rights violations in Egypt, France, for one, said it would not condition its arms sale to Egypt to human rights issue. What do you make of that?
This is typical realpolitik. Realpolitik has always prevailed after the tragic experience of Europe with the Arab winter that brought refugees and Daesh to the shores of Europe. There is a Western realization that human rights and democratization are slow historical processes that cannot be pushed forward without risking their own national security. And so today, many Western governments do not care about human rights. They can only pay lip service. They can talk to the media here and there. But when it comes to actual policy, nothing will change.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, discussing these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. 40 people are feared dead after a motorized boat capsized on Lake Kivu in eastern Congo's South Kivu province. The Associated Press reports the boat was headed towards the regional capital Goma when it sank. Authorities say 56 people have been rescued. Eastern Congo has long been plagued by disastrous boat accidents since vessels are often overloaded with passengers and cargo. Road networks in the country's far east are poor and often under the control of armed groups, so many choose to travel by water despite the risks of drowning. Recent violence in Mali, Niger, and the Central African Republic have left hundreds dead in recent weeks. But the United States envoy to the Sahel region says there is hope in the West Africa region, as several nations have recently held peaceful polls, with more elections to come in 2021. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The top U.S. envoy to Africa's Sahel region acknowledges that it has been a rough few weeks in the sprawling desert region, which covers the West African nations of Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. The region is beset by a wave of deadly violence from extremist groups, with more than 1,000 violent incidents in the first half of 2020, according to a report from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Most recently, in western Niger, extremists attacked three villages, killing more than 100 civilians. Peter Pham, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel, strongly condemned the attacks in a call to journalists this week, calling the perpetrators cowardly and godless. But he quickly added, there is cause for hope as Niger heads to a second round of presidential elections in February.
We have congratulated the people of Niger who exercised their democratic right to vote in their presidential and legislative elections on December 27th and look forward to observing an equally successful runoff presidential election process on February 21st. These elections hold the promise of Niger's historic first peaceful transition of power from one democratically elected president to another.
It's no accident, Pham told journalists, that he mentions elections and instability in the same breath. That's because he contends that these outbreaks of violence across the region have one common cause.
The heart of the crisis in the Sahel, as I've repeatedly emphasized, is one of state legitimacy. Whether or not citizens perceive that their government is legitimate, equitable, able and willing to meet their needs. This includes ensuring justice and accountability for human rights violations and abuses committed by security forces. Absent Sahelian government actions that demonstrate this commitment, no degree of international engagement is likely to succeed.
That's why he added the majority of U.S. government assistance to the region comes in the form of health, development, and humanitarian assistance. The U.S. has invested over $1.5 billion in those sectors from 2017 to 2019. In that same time period, he said, the U.S. provided about $467 million in security assistance. Ornella Moderan, a researcher who heads the Sahel program for the Institute for Security Studies, agrees on the importance of state legitimacy. She pointed to Mali, which had a coup in August because of this very lack of confidence in the state. But she said to truly build legitimate governments, societies have to come together voluntarily and have genuinely inclusive dialogue. She spoke to VOA via Skype from Bamako, Mali.
Now, the question I think is, to what extent can external actors like the U.S. actually support this and accompany this? There is a need for national ownership, and there's a need for dialogue, really, between ruling elites and common Malians. This is really the root cause of where we are right now. So it's important that while we're trying to reestablish a public dialogue, a national dialogue, that we make sure that everyone is included. And this means making sure that no ethnic groups are sidelined, no religious groups, no gender groups. And this is, of course, very challenging, but very important.
Is that happening? Maybe, said Pham, pointing to recent presidential elections in Ghana and Burkina Faso, where both incumbents were reelected. Pham was sent to both inaugurations as part of a U.S. presidential delegation. In both polls, the opposition cried foul, though the results were nevertheless certified, and both presidents have vowed to work for all citizens. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Conditions are worsening for refugees on the Ethiopia-Sudan border. More displaced people are arriving daily to swell the population of overcrowded camps. VOA's correspondent Heather Murdoch has extensively covered the refugee situation and recently was in camps along the Ethiopia-Sudan border. VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Heather Murdoch for an update.
Aid workers are working hard to accommodate the people that are coming into camps from across the border, and also the border camps, the ones that are near the border, have for the most part, the people have been moved into the main camp, Umrakuba. It's quite crowded as of now. So conditions there, I wouldn't want to say that they're not working to make them better, but the conditions are very harsh. I mean, it's really hard to get enough water to wash and cook, and people are struggling to have shelter. I spoke to some refugees today that were sheltering in a city near the border, and they've been told that they are no longer allowed to stay in the city. They're not legally in Sudan as residents. They're there as refugees. So they were told that in the next couple of days, they're going to be moved into yet another camp. And UNICEF has recently said that they're expecting another large influx of people to be coming across the border. So it's a constantly changing situation, but I cannot overstate how difficult it is day to day for the people living there, especially the most vulnerable people trying to get medicine or care for special needs children. It's nearly impossible.
What is the strain like for the local population?
Local people that I've spoke to at the beginning were very welcoming and going out of their way to try to bring food and shelter to people coming across the border. And it's not to say that people have been hostile. I haven't seen any of that. But I've seen a very real fear from people in local communities. They say that rents have already gone up. Prices of food have already skyrocketed. It's a poor country in general, and it's a very poor part of one of the poorest countries on earth to begin with. The local people are genuinely scared that if the refugee crisis continues and continues to worsen, that their situation will become unlivable as well.
What about issues of security?
There is an ongoing issue of border security. The area that a lot of people are coming from Ethiopia into Sudan, it's a heavily militarized area where Sudan, Ethiopia, and Eritrea all have a border within sight of each other and military bases in this area. And there has been some cross-border skirmishes. There's also been diplomacy on a high level trying to keep this area secure. I've been told that while when things are quiet, it's always an issue to worry about security in that area, because even high-level talks might not necessarily pan out on the ground. These are disputes over land, and at a time where resources are so slim for so many people in the area, a lot of local people are afraid that regardless of negotiations in the country's capitals, there still might be considerable security issues ongoing.
What challenges do aid agencies face in trying to make a difference in the lives of these refugees?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is access to the Tigray region. There are so many people displaced and homeless in the Tigray region itself that it's impossible to even count, because there's very little access for aid organizations and journalists, not just people displaced from the current conflict, but Eritrean people that had made their home as refugees in Ethiopia. The aid organizations on the ground in Sudan also face, besides trying to get enough just basic resources, money, food, water, shelters, it's also very remote areas. It's hard to get to. It's hard to get anything there to, like, there's not electricity wires going there. There's not internet there. There's not, for the most part, mobile phone service. The roads themselves are hard to get through. The closest camp to the nearest city is an hour and a half through a remote desert area. The ones closer to the border are something more like 5 to 7 hours nearest to the closest city in Sudan. So they're just difficult to get resources to the camps. And the Tigray region is still largely cut off.
That's VOA's Heather Murdoch speaking from Istanbul with VOA's Chinedu Ofor. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.